Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Now everyone, and welcome to another edition of Center Stage. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you for joining me tonight for what should be a very interesting history lesson. My guest tonight is Johnny Thomas, who is the mayor of Glendora, Mississippi. He was with us last week when I first discovered his connection to the Emmett Till story. His father was one of five black men who were present as Till was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered. His father was also there when they disposed of Emmett Till's body by dumping it in the Black Bayou that runs through Glendora, Mississippi. So tonight, Mr. Thomas will give us a real black history lesson about the death of Emmett Till. But before we begin, we want to remind you that the views and opinions of our guests do not necessarily reflect that of Center Stage, the host, or our advertisers. So, without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, help me welcome back to the stage Mayor Johnny Thomas. Good evening, Mr. Mayor. How are you?
Fine, Carrie, and you? Fine.
I am good. Listen, y'all, I like the mayor a lot. So, listen, we should have a good time tonight as we talk about the Emmett Till story, because I was absolutely fascinated when he told me the story this week. So, Mr. Mayor, we got 2 hours, so we can take our time and go slow tonight and really go over the details of this story, because, y'all, I was absolutely taken back by the details that the mayor was able to share with us about Emmett Till and the night that he was taken from his uncle's house and the other details about how he was tortured and the things that progressed from there. But, Mayor, let's begin by talking about Emmett Till was, first of all, coming from Chicago. So he was a northern boy who had never, it appears, spent time in the South. So tell us, as he was leaving Chicago, the information that his mother tried to share with him.
Well, you know, Carrie, Emmett leaving Chicago with probably the 10 or 15 minutes or history and the way of the South. His orientation was very short. He did not know the way of the South during the Jim Crow era, and especially here in the heart of the Mississippi Delta.
So his mother, did she stop him and try to explain to him, but I think he was running late for his ride or something into Mississippi, and so therefore she wasn't able to give him the full rundown of how, you know, blacks were being treated in Mississippi.
Yes, Gary. Let me just first set the stage as to, I represent the Ethic Museum, the Emmett Till Historic Intrepid Center Museum, and I will be coming from our history that we have recorded in our museum. And,
okay.
Of course, yes, Emmett was running late, and the mother called him back, and she had something to give him. And that was a ring that she had received from a deceased husband who was court-martialed in the military. And she received that ring, and she was giving that to Emmett. She called him back, gave him the history of what he was supposed to do and how he was supposed to act according to my oral histories that I have recorded and so forth, that he was given that information as to if he's walking down the street that he needs to get off the street. That's the way we had to do it back in those days.
You had to get off the street because a white person was coming down the street, right?
Exactly. And, of course, you could not speak to them unless they spoke to you, those kind of things. So Emmett did not know this. Of course, his short history lesson that he received from his Miss Mamie just wasn't good enough, especially after the child made it here and started to have fun and enjoy himself.
Okay, so Emmett, his mother tries to tell him or explain to him about Jim Crowism, but the history lesson was obviously not long enough, so when he came there, he really didn't understand the difference in the North and the South. Especially in the Mississippi Delta. So he gets to Money, Mississippi, where his Uncle Mo lives. And that day, I think he got there on August 20th, correct?
That's correct. That's correct.
And so it is you all's belief that Emmett had a picture in his wallet in which he was basically talking about or showing them as someone he knew, a white woman that he knew. Can you pick up the story there?
Yeah, some of the play and dare and those kind of things, young folks, especially us here in the Delta, had mm-hmm. no more other than fantasize, and we did a lot of that about the races and so forth. And, of course, there was, as I understand it, a dare to Emmett about him having a white picture in his pocketbook and the good-looking white lady that was probably that was in the store at the time. And that was probably a dare. The reason that ultimately the whistle came out of Emmett's mouth, as was authenticated by Mr. Simeon Wright, who Emmett was taken from the bed with.
Okay, but let's back up a second. So Emmett Till has a picture of his wallet of a white woman, and basically he was horse-playing around with the other cousins of his, talking about, you know, how, I guess, whatever he was saying about him and white women. And so you all are of the belief that Emmett was dared by the others to say something to a white woman before they went to town that day.
Exactly. That is the history lesson.
Okay. And so when they get to town and he's with his cousins, what happens then?
Well, the story, as we laid out in our effort to begin the healing, is that Simeon Wright says that they went to the store in Money, Mississippi, and the gentleman that he came to Mississippi with went in the store and bought goods and came out, and of course Emmett went in, and of course Simeon went in and to follow him because he did not want him to get out of place, and Simeon knew the way of the South, being 11 years old at that time, and so he went in to harness anything that might get out of line with Emmett, and nothing did. Nothing did in this. According to Simeon, they came out of the store, and a lady came out, Mrs. Bryant came out and headed toward her car, and that is when the terrible thing happened, or the times happened, when Emmett did let out what we call in the Delta here, a wolf whistle.
A wolf whistle. So Emmett is with how many? He's with Simeon, and it's Emmett, and who else is with him the day that Emmett whistles at the white woman?
Well, there was several of them together. Some of his cousins, other cousins other than Simeon, Reverend Parker, and I believe they said there was a young lady also with them who acknowledged that they probably needed to that they was not going to hear. That was not the last of that happening. She knew the men and knew that they was pretty tough men, Gestapos or whatever type mentalities, and she knew something would happen as a result of that whistle. So she tried.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
She tried to instill that to those young men that definitely. Something was probably going to be done about it, and of course, it wound up just as she predicted.
Okay, so let's set the stage for it. When the mayor told me the story at this stage, I was scared, and that was back in 1950, way before my time. But just the way he set the stage was just incredible. So, Mayor, you said when Emmett whistled at the white woman, Mrs. Bryant, that everybody that was with Emmett was scared to death. Tell them how you told me. What happened when Emmett whistled at the white woman? What did they do?
Well, the oral history that we've gathered that from the authentic individuals that were there and is displayed in our museum, it's clearly that it was complete pandemonium. They didn't know what to do. They all ran and jumped in their vehicle and took off up the road, headed home. They were just fearful to death. And, of course, Emmett still being playful and not understanding what he had done until he felt and saw the fear of his cousins and so forth, he then became fearful himself.
So wait, Emmett, y'all, like, pay attention to what the mayor's saying here. Emmett didn't even get at that point what everybody was so excited about until he began to see the terror on their face, because the rest of them knew that really bad stuff was about to happen. And so Emmett at this point becomes afraid himself because he realizes, oh, my God, if they're this scared, then I probably should be scared at this point. But why is it that, okay, let me say it like this. When that happened, what happened when they got home?
Well, before they got home, they were so terrified, according to Reverend Parker, before they got home, they saw a vehicle coming behind them, and they thought it was the Bryants coming after them. And they got so afraid that they stopped the vehicle and jumped out and ran down through the cotton field.
It was terrifying.
Yeah, wound up that it wasn't anybody looking for him, just a neighbor going home, and as a result, they got back in the vehicle, and that's when Emmett really became terrified, and of course begging them not to reveal what he had done for fear of being sent back home while he was having such fun. And, of course, they was as well with their cousin from Chicago.
So Emmett still not getting how much trouble he was in, instead of going home and immediately telling Uncle Moles, who would have known what to do, Emmett wanted to continue to, I guess, enjoy his summer in Mississippi, not understanding what was to come of that whistle that he had made at that white woman, or whistle asked the white woman that he didn't know what was coming.
That's right. That's right. I tell you, looking back at when Mrs. Till sent Emmett off, and she said she don't know why he would say what he said, but when he got ready to go, after receiving the ring from her, he gave her his watch and
mm-hmm.
told her, Mom, you keep this. I don't need it where I'm going.
Wow. Wow.
I don't know
wow.
why he was. That is what really was also disturbing and something of a nature of course.
No one would ever understand why he did it.
Yes. No one.
He probably didn't know why he was doing it at the time. Okay, so fast forward, they get home. Did they tell anybody at home what had happened while they were in town?
Oh, no. That's, when they got home, that was a hush-hush.
Okay.
That was a hush, as I understand it, until one fellow that was around the place at the time, is the way I understand it, revealed to the husband. I don't even think the wife told until she had to tell once one of the individuals, that African Americans that was around there, heard it and told Mr. Bryant, as I understand it, for a meager 25-cent worth of credit as to whether he had heard what that boy did the other day.
Wow. So are you saying Brian's wife didn't tell him what happened?
Well, I think she was had to reveal it after.
Okay. But she knew that there would be trouble if she told him what Emmett Till had said to her. So she didn't tell him. A black man told what Emmett Till had said to the store owner, Mr. Bryant, because the lady that Emmett whistled at was a store owner. Her and her husband owned a store in Money, Mississippi, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so this black person revealed to Mr. Bryant, who I understand was out of town when it happened, that Emmett Till had whistled at the white at Mr. Bryant's wife just for 25 cents worth of store credit?
That's correct.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so now Mr. Bryant, who is not a very nice man from what history shows, was told that Emmett had whistled at his wife. So then what happens? This wasn't immediately because he was out of town, so this is several days later when he gets back in town?
No, this is on the this is several days later after he gets back to town.
Right.
This happened.
And, well, I'm sorry.
The whistle took place on the 24th.
Okay, on the 24th. Okay. And so, oh, that's right. Emmett gets in town on the 20th, and he whistles at the woman on the 24th. And Brian gets into town, back into town, several days later.
Several days later, after the whistle.
After the whistle. Okay. And so, it's just, you know, Brian finds out that Emmett has whistled at his wife, and then what happened?
Oh, well, then the premeditation as far as concern took place. That is when, and how we say here in Condor that we are the birthplace of modern civil rights, because Bryant, after being revealed what had happened to in reference to his wife, had to get in contact with J.W. Marlin, who
which is his half brother.
His half brother who lived in Glendora, and he had to go to Money and pick him up. And after picking him up, he then brought Bryant to the house where they kidnapped the kid.
Now they, you know, this isn't broad daylight, y'all. This is like what, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning?
That's about 2:30 in the morning, according to Uncle Mose.
Okay, so at, let's just say, 2:30 on the morning of the 28th, Uncle Mose gets a knock at the door. Who is it?
Right, Brian. Want to talk to you about the boy. Don't you got two? Do you have two boys here from Chicago?
Wow.
And Uncle Mose, knowing Mr. Bryant, opened the door, and that's what he saw standing at the door. One man with the 45 in one hand, flashlight in the other one. Another white man with him who he recognized to be Mr. Bryant, and and he saw a black man standing outside with his head down, attempting to conceal who he was.
Okay, for whatever reason, Mary, your phone is breaking up. I'm not sure if you're on speaker or for whatever reason, but it's breaking up, so we're going to have to go back there and start again. So it's 2:30 in the morning. Let me set the stage here. It's 2:30 in the morning, and Mr. Bryant, and is it Milam with him? Milam, Bryant, and a black man?
Yes.
Okay. Go to Uncle Moe's house, and Uncle Moe is Emmett Till's uncle, great-uncle.
And great-uncle, yes.
Mm-hmm. Great-uncle. And so he goes to the house, and he tells him that he wants to see the two boys from Chicago.
Yes, he wanted to know if he had two boys there from Chicago. And
okay.
He told him he did. Yeah.
Okay. And so at that point, Uncle Mose just says, I mean, okay, you want to see him? Or I mean, he allows them to see him? Or what does Uncle Mose think he's allowing them to do? Does he think he's just allowing them to come in and talk to him? Or what is Uncle Mose's understanding of what's about to happen?
Well, they told Uncle Mose that they want to talk to him. They want to get that boy from Chicago, the one that did all that talk. And that's the one, and that they would take him. They would, if he's the wrong one, we would bring him back. But if he's the right one, we're just going to give him a beating and then bring him all back home. So that was the way of the South at that time, especially if we got out of line, or even in after got the line. He would be beaten by those peoples under the Jim Crow era and let you go. That's what Uncle Mose depended on and thought what would happen.
Now, this is the part that really shook me up, y'all, because I guess I was born after the 50s, so it just seemed like so amazingly, like, crazy to me, that how many people was in Uncle Mo's, how many men was in Uncle Mo's house that night?
There was approximately 5 men with Uncle Mo's.
Okay, so Uncle Mo's is
in the
house.
I mean, not all men, but young boys and young men, yes.
Okay, so of Uncle Mo's clan that's already in the house, there's 5 or 6 of them, and who comes to the door is 2 white men and a black man in the yard holding his head down, and they allow Mr. Bryant to take him away instead of them fighting and realizing, okay, this isn't going to happen, we're not going to let this happen. Instead, they allow Emmett to leave with Mr. Bryant, not knowing what's going to happen. Because, you know, beating in the South could very easily turn into a hanging at that time, could it not?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But Patriot thought that they would do what they said they would do. And, of course, that wound up not being the case.
Okay.
But you gotta understand that Mose, when they came looking for that boy, and, of course, Mose, opposition to that boy going could have resulted in all the boys going. Or with the man standing there with a gun in his hand like that, probably everybody murdered right there. Any resistance. And, of course, the way of the South, we knew that that's what it was.
Wow.
And so there was nothing that Mose could do other than. And some would say that he was fearful, but he was probably frightened for all of the generations behind him. Because as
so,
we see, if it's a 14-year-old, no difference.
So you believe, and this is where your father comes into the story. History says that your father was the black man that was in the yard with his head down.
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct.
And your father's name... For the record, your father's name is, or was, because your father's deceased now, your father's name was?
Henry Lee Loggins.
Okay, so Mr. Loggins was in the yard with his head down, so many people would wonder, like, why would a black man be involved in torturing another black man and ultimately killing them? And you say it was because of Jim Crowism.
Well, it was strictly Jim Crowism. Jim Crowism created a certain breed of us, especially African Americans back then. It was those that pretty much betrayed everything by being totally quiet about anything and everything, or being involved with it, especially if the white man asked them or told them to do anything. If not, then you're committing suicide as well. My father would have committed suicide had he not did what Milam told him to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he could have done. But
so for the record,
Jim
father had no choice but to help.
Well, during Jim Crowism, you had no choice but to help. But a lot of other things went along with the Jim Crowism piece is that African Americans, some of them was treated and granted different ways of life than others and a better way of life and those kind of things like that, treated a little bit different than others. And that's his way of Jim Crowism. So it was a harsh thing. It was very harsh. And,
well, a lot of people back in the day would say there was the house Negro and then there was the field Negro. And I guess what you're saying is your father would have been considered the house Negro.
Well, he would have been clearly.
Okay.
He was J.W.'s right hand, as I understand it, back then. And, of course, that gave him a certain amount of status.
And that's J.W. as in J.W. Milam, the half-brother of Bryant.
J.W. Milam, yes.
Right. And so you said that Reverend Parker, what did Reverend Parker say was the mood in the house at night when they came to get Emmett? What was the atmosphere?
Well, Reverend Parker says that it was complete terror. You just didn't want to imagine, and you can't imagine the type of terror that was for him. And he was about 16, I believe. at the time, and Emmett was about 14. That it was just complete terror.
Okay, so they take Emmett from the, or though they're about to take Emmett from the house, and this was another thing that I found shocking. You said Emmett still not understanding what was about to happen. How was Emmett progressing as far as when they told him to put on his clothes and come with them? What did he do?
Well, you know, when they told Emmett to let's go, his very limited orientation he had received from his mother just had not kicked in. Emmett was used to taking his time and dressing properly, getting fully dressed, put his socks on, not saying yes, sir, or no, sir, taking his time, saying yes and no. And they wanted to whoop him in the room.
Wow.
But then they, because he was continuing to say yes and no and just didn't know where he was headed to.
Okay, y'all, we're going to break right here because this is where it's about to get good. Or I shouldn't say good. This is where it's about to, I guess, take a fatal turn. You just tuned in. You come center stage tonight for the topic, What Happened the Night Emmett Till Died? That's the topic tonight, y'all. What happened the night Emmett Till died? Tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by Texas Investor Realty. You can call there and speak with Robert Lewis. If you're looking for a house anywhere in the DFW Metroplex area, Robert Lewis is your man. You can reach him at 214-467-0467. Tonight's segment of Center Stage is also being brought to you by New Solution Social Media Services. That's New Solution Social Media Services. Their website is newsolutionsocialmedia.com. They offer social media services for small businesses and entrepreneurs looking to generate new customers from various online sources. They provide web content management. They build web and blog sites to maximize a company's online presence. They also build and manage a company's online reputation and provide social media campaigns through Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and Dailymotion. Okay, back to what happened the night Emmett Till died. So, Mayor, from there, they take Emmett from the house, leaving everybody there in terror. They didn't take Simeon, who was also with Emmett that night. They just took Emmett.
Just Emmett. Took Emmett out of the bed with them, Simeon.
Okay.
And, of course,
go ahead.
When they took him out to the vehicle, Uncle Moe said that he heard a soft voice say, that's him.
Ooh.
As if, though, which have always been powered down, I believe a warrant might have been issued in 55 for Mrs. Bryant, but never executed. But it's alleged that she was the soft voice that said, yes, that's him. And they moved away from the house back toward money, wounding up in Glendora.
Okay, so they take Emmett from the house, and they do what with him at that point?
When they take him from the house, they take him and they put him in the truck.
Okay, so they put him in the
truck.
I'm sorry?
After he's identified as the one that did the talk, then in the back of the truck, they put him and off to Glendora. And
so,
that is where.
And that was to J.W. Milam's house.
That is the house seat that sits right in front of the museum, Ethic Museum. All of that lot there is sacred ground for J.W. Milam's house, is where they did probably the fatal blow on the young man, because the story that J.W. Milam and Bryant tell about what happened in that Bryant got carried away and hit the child too hard, hit the boy too hard in Glendora, in the barn behind
J.W.
Milam House, yes.
But let's back up to how did the black man get involved? So it is believed that your father was with them when they picked him up. Was there another black man there as well, or when did the other black man come into play?
Well, there was supposed to be another black man, and there are five black men that they named from Glendora that was made to participate and work at that time for J.W. Milam. But that at the house was my father, who came back to Glendora with them, and at that point parted two other African-Americans, got with them after, and that's when they took a ride, as they pointed, all the way to Rosedale and back down to Sunflower County to visit a farm that was managed by one of the brothers of Milam and Bryant, Leslie Milam.
So they took, so really, in terms of kidnapping Emmett, they took him through several counties. Am I understanding that?
They took him to what they say in Look magazine. They actually took him from LeFlore County, brought him to Tallahatchie, from Tallahatchie to Bolivar County, Rosedale, then from Rosedale back down to Sunflower County.
That is wow. And so you can just imagine what Emmett Till went through that night and the fear that must have been in this 14-year-old's mind as he's being tortured. Now, I understand that several things happened to him. Is it true that they beat him and they gouged out his eye and they shot him? Is that correct?
Yes. When he got back to Sunflower County, we have orientation that we took from the young man that on Sunday morning was visiting a neighbor's house, mm-hmm. and he went by the barn of Leslie Milam where they had the kid early in the morning, and they was beating him, and he heard him hollering and crying and calling for mom, and he went down and got this lady and brought her back to see, let her hear what was happening. But when he got back with her to the site, everything was quiet. Everything was quiet, and they had. He said he when he was headed back out, he saw two black men come out of the barn and throw something rolled up in a tarp into the back of the truck.
So that is believed to have been Emmett Till's body.
That is believed to be Emmett Till's body, and of course. That same Sunday morning, we have oral history in our museum with a young man who still have nightmares now. Mr. Robert Walker happened to be about 6 or 7 years old at the time, and he actually witnessed blood dripping out of the J.W. Milam truck onto the streets here in Glendora on Sunday morning, and witnessed again them psalmists and my father back to participate in the disposal of the body, of which he saw them go down to where the museum is established now, the old cotton gin that is the museum, and retrieve a large fan from that museum and throw it over into the back of the truck. And ultimately, they found it with barbed wire tied around it, the fan, and around Emmett's neck. And according to my father, it was the history has it that it was the Tallahatchie River that they dropped the body in. But my father said, no, it was the Black Bag. And, of course, the body was found and drug from the mouth of the Black Bayou, which joined it from the Glendora Bridge to the mouth of where it was about to drop over into the running waters of the Tallahatchie River.
And he got hung up, correct?
got hung up there. God wasn't having it, and the body was found with the leg sticking up just on the rim of dropping over into the swift waters of the Tallahatchie. And, of course, the that would have been.
Wow. And so the next, how many days later was Emmett Till's body found after they dumped it?
They dumped it on the, it has to be on the morning of the 28th. I believe the FBI called it at the great part of the morning, they called it. At the dawn, they dropped the body. And so that would be the 28th, and they found it 3 days later.
And that's when a fisherman reported to the deputy sheriff that there was a body in the water.
That is when a fisherman reported to a deputy sheriff that there was a body in the bayou there.
Well, did you see a leg? Was it a leg sticking up, he saw?
Leg sticking up, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the fan was tied around his neck with the barbed wire, who at that time had penetrated his head.
You know, and I was just asking the mayor 100 questions, y'all, when we went over this in the pre-interview, and I was like, Mayor, what was the atmosphere in the town like when word got around that Emmett Till's body had been found? And I'm going to let the mayor tell y'all what he told me. Mayor, what was the atmosphere that day when it first broke that Emmett Till had been found dead?
Well, of course, during Jim Crowism, the first thing was we was all the way quiet. And it was just totally fear. My midwife, who happened to be Mrs. Hester Stevenson, telling me she actually lived right across the road from J.W. Milam. And she thought every minute, every time a train would come through town, she would think that it was planes coming to bomb the house of J.W. Milam or bomb them. They was just fearful then. And, of course, they were so fearful. My father had been kidnapped or taken off and put incarcerated under a false name, under alias.
Wait a minute. Let's back up so we can be clear. So the midwife was afraid who was going to bomb J.W. Mollin's house.
Well, you know, it was just fear. I don't know where the region and what was coming from at that time. Other
she was
than
just
fearful
she was
for...
just afraid
for,
in general. Just didn't know what was going to happen.
Afraid in general. Everybody was afraid in general. Nobody would even talk.
So black folks weren't even talking amongst black folks like on the porch like we tend to do. We weren't even doing that or standing on the corner. They weren't even doing that.
Exactly.
Okay. And so your father, because he knew what happened that night, along with another man, were put in jail and under John Doe, so that what? They were arrested for what?
Actually, they said that they knew too much and they was put in jail to prevent them from being able to testify in the case. That's what the whole thrust of thing was. Is to get them out of the way, that would automatically give them vindication or they would be acquitted by the all-white jury.
So there were five black men. Why did they just take the two and put them in jail?
Well, the other, that's a good question.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good question. I'm thinking that those two probably was the deepest in it.
Okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
That was others that worked for J.W. Milam at the time. One of them ran the store, worked at the store that was supposed to have been involved. That's Otha Wallace, and that was Odie Brown, and that was Willie Hubbard, who disappeared the night. He was one of the other ones that supposed to have taken over from my father that went on the drunken spree where they beat the child over in Sunflower County. He disappeared, Willie Hubbard.
Did he ever resurface, or was he never heard of again?
He has a son by my aunt, who is Joe Willie as well. Just left my house. I was just thinking about that. But he never did resurface. I think we might have saw him once since that time.
So the black man involved and basically or were there when Emmett Till was kidnapped, tortured, murdered, and disposed of was Harry Loggins, which was your father. You say Otha Wallace, Willie Hubbard, and Odie Brown?
And Too Tight Collins, who wound up being Leroy Too Tight Collins. Leroy Collins was his name, but they named him as Too Tight. Too Tight tells a story to the Chicago Tribune, way different than others have told it. He talked about how rather than shooting Emmett through the side of the head with the 45, they took a drill, an old-fashioned wood drill, and just drilled it through the side of his head. And that they had torched him, burned him, and gouged his eyes, just had really, really tortured the kid.
And we can only assume that they tortured his or put out one of his eyes. So I guess as a message to say to any other black man, don't look at white women or don't whistle at white women?
Well, they found Mrs. Till, she did a personal autopsy of the child's body. When she got it back to Chicago shortly, found that one of his eyes was out and ran down on his cheek. But she said it looked like to her they had taken a hatchet and just shaved all the front of his face off, hit him down across the front of his face, shaved his nose out, and then took the same hatchet and just hit him center of the head and just severed the head.
Now, are we understanding per history that the black men, that being your father, Harry Loggins, Otha Wallace, Willie Hubbard, Odie Brown, and Leroy Too Tight Collins, were they're just observing and moving things, or were they also participating in the torture and the murder of Emmett Till?
Well, you know, Jim Crowism, I would guarantee you that they did probably all the work while they stood back and listened and laughed, and probably the African Americans under duress, under the guard, probably did all of this to the kid. That's what the tale have it around here is. That's what happened.
That the black men actually were the ones who tortured and murdered Emmett Till.
That is not what, according to J.W. Milam and the Look magazine, they reported it that it all happened from them just to prevent any other backlash or any other recall of the verdict that they had, a retrial.
Because they knew by the time they gave the interview to Look magazine that they were covered under double jeopardy, so they couldn't be retried for the murder of Emmett Till.
Exactly.
Okay. And so those two white men that we're referring to as I'm not going to call him Mr. Tonight, Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam, and they were half-brothers. They had the same mother but different fathers. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay. Exactly. What was Milam's reputation?
You know, Milam was a World War II veteran, I believe, and he, around here, the old folks tell me that he thought that he had all the ways with African Americans, and I guess he did. He was a very tall, big, tall, burly man. Mm. I did get a chance to see him once here in Glendora at an older age myself. But he was a big, really bad man, and they tell about how, in this little store here, that how he would beat black men as if though they was kids across the head with sticks and all that. He, Plus, my mom tells the tale that even if they were sick during that time, he would come in the house and make them go to the field, even though they might be sick. So he was a real Gestapo. Mm.
So let's talk about the trial. So by now, Emmett Till's body has been found. Let's go to the funeral. Let's talk about Emmett. I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm so excited to tell this story. I'm getting ahead of myself. So Emmett Till's body is found, and what happens when Emmett Till's mother wants to take her son's remains back to Chicago?
Well, you know, when they found and retrieved Emmett's body from the mouth of the Black Bayou, they immediately sent it to Greenwood and ordered a burial immediately.
They tried to bury his body in 24 hours. So were they just not going to even let his mother have her son's body and do with it as she will? They were going to take total responsibility and pay for the cost and everything and do this for what? I mean, really?
They were going to bury her without even notifying her, it seems. She knew that they was going to bury it, attempting to bury it. So she took the necessary steps, as brave as she was, to call on and to get all of the politics involved, from the governor on down to the mayor of Chicago. And they then, in turn, pressured the South to do something about it. And they ultimately wound up exhuming the body and taking it wound up in Tutwiler, Mississippi, here in Tallahatchie County, where the body was made ready by Mr. Woodrow Jackson and brought back to Chicago by Mr. Crosby Smith, an uncle of Mrs. Till.
Okay, let's back up. So you're saying they went ahead and buried his body?
It is my understanding that they had put him in the ground and was about ready to cover him.
When she was able to get the mayor involved and the governor involved and some congresspeople involved to stop all that.
That's right. She did get congressmen as well.
And so they stop that, and they get Emmett Till's body back to Chicago. And Emmett Till's mother decides, I want the world to see what they did to my son.
Exactly.
So Miss Till then decides to have an open casket and a public funeral.
That's right. That's right. And that is where I say the healing began. She started the dialogue. She started the dialogue, and therefore it shall forever move forward.
But when that happened,
yeah, when they shipped the body from Mississippi, they shipped it to Chicago. And there was a problem getting somebody to accept the body. And I believe it was reported that it had to stay at Mrs. Till's house all night until they finally found a mortuary that, not mortuary, but a funeral parlor that would take the body.
So they were afraid, even in Chicago, to take Emmett Till's body?
Well, it was probably the stench. I think it was it was pretty rough. The stench,
okay.
I think it was, that happened.
So decomposition
happened. I don't know if that's what it was.
Okay, decomposition had began to set in and that type of thing. Okay.
Oh, yes.
So she has the public funeral. She has the open casket. And the images were sent to magazines across the country. That's when the reporters began to... And we all know that Emmett Till's mother took it very hard, you know, what happened to her son. Let's be clear on that. And that was very public. And she, you know, in many ways was, you like to call it, that was the beginning of the civil rights movement, right?
Oh, yes. That's the beginning of modern civil rights.
And so when she was brave enough to do that, that put media attention on Glendora like nobody had ever seen. And I understand when the reporters got there, the Black folks were scared to talk.
Yeah, we had one black reporter that worked that case, Mr. James Hicks.
Mm-hmm.
He actually was here to work the case, and he wound up coming to Sumner, Mississippi, to a funeral on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
And when he attended that funeral, he was looking, I guess, suspicious or what have you at this black funeral. But he said that there was one young lady that hid behind a vehicle and asked him, say, are you one of those reporters down here working the Emmett Till case? And he started to look back to see who was talking to him. She said, don't look. She was even afraid to talk to a stranger. That's how much fear it was. And she's at a funeral at a black church. But they didn't want any other African-American, I guess, to see her talking to a reporter. And that's what took place. And he said, I'm here working the case. And she said, well, if you want to know what happened, go to Little Glendora.
Mm.
And that is what Jay wrote about, and that's what he did. He came to Glendora after the funeral. And at Glendora, he was looking to see, because there was all rumors that witnesses had been tampered with or kidnapped and so forth. So he was looking for Too Tight.
And Too Tight and your father, Harry Loggins, weren't, you know, technically kidnapped, because they were taken to jail, put under John Doe's. But wasn't it true that they told people that they were dead?
Well, they reported it to the Chicago Tribune. The Chicago Tribune wrote that they actually was dead because they knew too much and was with J.W. Milam and Brian.
Okay.
But Hicks did find out that information.
Really? So we know then that The funeral was very public, and it got national attention. Media got to your town. Your father is arrested. The other man is arrested along with him. Nobody knows where they are. They are believed to be dead. And so what is the mood of Glendora? You know, now Emmett Till's dead. They believe your father's dead. They believe, Too Tight was dead, too. Or was it Leroy Too Tight? Collins was dead. So what is the mood of Glendora? Black people must have been petrified.
Oh, it was. My mom told James Hicks she was afraid to even let anybody know that she hadn't seen my father for approximately 2 weeks or so at that time. Until she opened up to James Hicks, they was just totally afraid.
And I want to back up a second, because I forgot one important part of the story that I thought was just totally, I don't know, I guess it was just, to me, amazing how many people were involved in this. The day that it was discovered that, I believe, Emmett Till's body was found, what happened with the black worker who said she was working for the mother of the murderers? Let's go back to that just a second, because, y'all, this is so crucial to just how many people were involved with this thing. So when the black worker was working for the murderer's mother, and she gets a phone call that says that Emmett Till, we're assuming that she's hearing that Emmett Till has been killed, what happens?
Yes. We have oral history that on the day of the body being found and the subsequent arrest of J.W. Milam and Bryant, this young lady that we have oral history with said that she was in the store of Mrs. Bryant when the call came in, and she came out of the kitchen and she picked up the phone, and she turned red as a peach and said, she said, you did what? You did what? And at that time, summons everybody to be at her house. Everybody, be here now.
And when you say everybody, you refer to everybody as in?
The Bryant clan, the Milam clan.
Okay. And did that include the sheriff?
she hung up and she told them, said, everybody be here and I'll take care of the rest.
Mm.
And she hung up the phone and she paid the young lady and told her, don't come back, I'll find you. And the young lady said she left and went home, and she told her mom and dad, said, Mom, said, and Dad, something has happened, and it's bad. And she said, in a matter of minutes, the sheriff came through with the trail of vehicles behind him.
Mm.
And in a matter of minutes, it looked like a association down at Mrs. Bryant's store.
Association as in the KKK Association, I'm just saying.
Big meat. That's right.
I'm just saying.
With the sheriff leading.
And by the way, the cotton gin where the fan that they used to use as a weight to weigh down Emmett Till that night, that fan came from the cotton gin that was owned by who?
That was owned by the then mayor
of
the town of Glendora.
Wow. So that's
it. It's now the museum and belonging to the mayor of Glendora now.
So that just shows you how many people were complicit in this whole thing. You know, the sheriff, the mayor, you know, it just really ran, it seems extremely deep. So, you know, we know now that a lot of people are involved, more than likely, but we know Milam and Bryant were the two white people that ordered Emmett Till be brought out the house, and we know that there were five black people that were took part in the killing, but they were made to do it. And so that said, the trial, I understand, was a speedy trial. All of this from the time that I understand Emmett Till whistled at the white woman on the street that day until the trial and the ultimate verdict was all in a matter of 30 days. Is that true?
All within a matter of 30 days.
Mm.
Yeah.
Talking about a speedy trial.
And, of course, they picked the jurors. We are a two-county seat here in Tallahassee County, so they didn't pick a jury of his peers for fear that it would cause an uproar here on the plantation side. And they went to the hills and got the 12 white jurors that had no ties or kinship with the flat man in the plantation.
And then when you told me in the pre-interview, I thought to myself, would it really have mattered back in those days if they came from the north side or the east side of the county? Or I just don't know how that probably would have changed the verdict.
Well, it would have changed. It would have probably changed the verdict some because, you know, you probably the change of it would have been that there was about 11,000 of us on this side of the county in the flatland on the plantations. And in the hills,
when you say
us,
you're referring to black people? Are you referring to African-Americans or just the population over there?
African-Americans.
So do you really believe back in that day they were going to put some African-Americans on the jury?
Well, they wouldn't put them on the jury, but they worked for them. And they was in there working in the house. They was running the fields for them. And I don't think they wanted to upset that in any kind of way, because it could have very well caused an uproar. And that's what they thought it would do. So therefore, they went and outside, or having to have these black men over here on these plantations look at one of them who had made the verdict.
Wow. The way you explain Jim Crowism, you know, back in that time, and by the way, when this happened, the mayor was 1 year, 8 months, and 28 days. So the mayor was very young, very, very young at that time. But the way you describe Jim Crowism back then, I just don't know that it would have been a black person or a white person that would have found the verdict or come to a different verdict than what was found anyway. I really don't see that. I don't see how it could have possibly affected anything by, you know, which side of the counties they came from. I don't, and I may be wrong, y'all, but I'm just saying it just seemed like if black folks were that afraid that they would murder another black man just because he whistled at a white woman because two white men told him to do it, what would have made anything different for the verdict?
Wouldn't it probably have made any different other than just that possibility? Possibility of an uproar. And, of course, you know the Great Migration where they took off from down here, like Florida going east after that. That caused a real migration away from here. That situation there, young folks, mothers sent their kids out of here. They got away as soon and fast as they could. So all of it still had an effect, but not as they thought it would. They thought it would be an uproar, as I understand it.
Okay. And so to be clear, the jury was an all white jury, and I understand they were all male.
All white jury, all male, with the sheriff as a defense, testifying as on behalf of the defense.
Wow. And so what exactly did the sheriff testify to?
Well, the sheriff testified that there is no way that this can be a 14-year-old nigga. Look at him. This is a 60 or 70-year-old nigga, and ain't no way it's no 14-year-old. That's what the sheriff testified to. Therefore, the jury said, you know, they couldn't find no counterweight guilty. Because of that. The sheriff had told him that's what it was, and that was it.
Well, wait a minute. Teal's mother, Miss Teal, Miss Maddie, Mammy, also testified, did she not?
Well, Miss Mammy was also testified for the defense. The first question, the attorney Whitten, who was the nephew of longtime Congressman Whitten, first question he asked Mrs. Teal when she was subpoenaed and put on stand was that, isn't it true, Mrs. Teal, that your Emmett is in Detroit walking the street and you're just down here trying to collect those 5 and 10 cent insurance policies?
That was cruel. That was cruel. And Mrs. Teal's answer was brilliant. What did Mrs. Teal say?
I do know that this is my son.
And that took a lot of courage being down there in the South, I'm sure, because the intimidation factor that was must have been in the courtroom that day.
Oh, the intimidation was crazy. She said it was so crazy to the little kids were running around playing, shooting at you with cap pistols, popping at you.
The white kids.
Just like the little white kids. Yeah.
So we know in the trial, Miss Teal testified. We know that the sheriff testified. Was there anybody else who testified?
Well, those are the two that we testified on behalf of the defense from the other side, state side. But then you had the young man that first ever, probably in the South or in Mississippi, to testify as to what he heard on Sunday morning. And that's Mr. Willie Reed, who immediately after getting off the stand had a nervous breakdown, and they had to take him away from here to Chicago. He just recently passed about 3-4 weeks ago.
Wow. And so just the stress of it all just took his toll.
Took a toll. He had a nervous breakdown. And, of course, we interviewed him in 2010. And you could see the fear and the terror that was in his eyes and the water written of his eyes as we interviewed him. He's an old man, but you could see the fear and the terror that was still there as to that day. And it seems as if it was clear as that day to him.
And, you know, I can only imagine, you know, the atmosphere in the courtroom. I have some images on the screen, as you see, the courtroom was filled with white men and all white men. I don't think I saw any white women in the courtroom. And so it was, I'm sure, total intimidation for anybody that was African American stepping on the stand and trying to come into an atmosphere like that. But the verdict, tell us how long it took for them to come back with a verdict.
You know, I tell you, these young men, they said that they would have finished the verdict. They would have deliberated, brought the verdict out earlier. But they took time and had drinks, drinking pop, soda pop, and so forth. It took them 67 minutes to deliberate.
67 minutes. Wow, that's crazy. So to give you all a timeline, Emmett got to town on August 20th. August 24th is when he whistled at the white woman. August 28th is when he was abducted. And August 31st is when they found the body. So literally 30 days later, you know, they got a verdict back, and these guys are found not guilty. Is that correct?
That's right, found not guilty.
Oh, that's crazy. So, you know, I don't know, and I can imagine people wanting to get out of Glendora and money Mississippi when after all this happened. What was it like? And I know you were a child then, but what did you hear things were like for black folk after Emmett Till died? I mean, what was the atmosphere for black folks? Were they living in fear, you know, on a day-to-day basis, or what was it like?
Well, you know, Jim Crow was another way as well. You know what I mean? It's basically the same way now. You fear reprisal in standing up or coming forward to talk about anything. When you depended on others to even for the basics of going to the doctor. Back then, the plantation that I lived on, he had his own food stamps. But we could get clothes and shoes and everything off him. And, of course, then you never got out of debt. Pretty much a penis type of system that we was living on. And it ain't too much better now. With the way that things are going, especially in the African-American community here in the Mississippi Delta. But
you know, many felt like Milam and Bryant should have been charged with kidnapping and murder. But what were they ultimately charged with?
Well, they were just kidnapped charged with murder. The kidnapping never came to fruition. There was never a true bill issued for the kidnapping. And, of course, the murder couldn't take place except for they kidnapped him. But Lee Floyd County, who was one of those other counties just as horrible at that time as it showed up to be, because one of the individual that killed Megan Evers was from Lee Floyd County in Greenwood. So you couldn't expect any more from them, and there was no true bill issued as to kidnapping.
So, you know, we understand that both of the murderers from Glendora, or was it just Bryant from Glendora and Milam was from Lee?
Just Milam and the African Americans that were made to participate.
Okay, so Milam was from Glendora.
Who are now being called accomplices.
Oh, so now the five black people that assisted with, you know, the torture, the murder, and the disposing of Emmett Till's body are now being called accomplices, as opposed to the fact that they were actually just made to assist with what was going on that night.
Under duress, they're now accomplices. They're calling them accomplices.
Okay, now when did the term accomplices enter the picture? How many years ago did that start?
Well, that's been about, we had a national Emmett Till civil rights in Tallulah, Alabama, Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And that is when I first heard of the accomplishment's path.
And how long ago was that?
That was about 3-4 years ago.
About 3-4 years ago.
Just creeping up, yeah.
So most of these men are dead by now, right?
They are all dead. all of the African-American. My father was the very last to pass away. The only other person that's living is Mrs. Bryant.
And that's the woman,
North Carolina.
That's the woman Emmett Till whistled at. So
yeah.
If everybody is dead, what is the point of calling them accomplices now? Is that just a smear campaign? Or is it, you know, now nobody's allowed to testify, so we can just put anything out there? What do you think the purpose of putting that out there now is?
Well, you know, accomplices, they were accomplices. I feel that they was accomplices, but they was made to be accomplices. They had no choice.
But, I mean, if you force me to shoot someone, then I'm not an accomplice. In my opinion, I was made to do it, so I don't know what the term I would use for that is, but I don't think I should be, because to me, an accomplice should be charged.
Yes.
Yeah,
well, that
so that it doesn't seem
that
fair
would be
to charge. I think anybody is smart enough to realize that if Milam and Bryant could have put the blame on the 5 black people, they would have back then. So when did Milam and Bryant pass away?
That was in 80 and 90.
And so they lived. What kind of lives did they live after the Emmett Till story?
Well, from what I hear, they moved around quite a bit from Texas back to Washington County to Bolivar County and somewhat in LeFleur County some. But they wound up being at the bottom of the rail. Coach J.W. Milam at that time, he was pretty much the only farmer around here that had mechanical equipment, so he harvested all the crops. So and he cared for all the crops, so he made all the money.
Before Emmett Till, before they kill Emmett Till, or after they kill Emmett Till, or did this
before.
After?
Before.
It was before.
Yes.
And
was,
so after he killed Emmett Till, then their lifestyle changed, and they hit the bottom of the barrel as opposed to being wealthy people in the town.
Exactly, they hit the bottom of the barrel and. Of course, other things happen around here. I tell you, in Glendora, as a result of the murder of Emmett Till, there was an individual that was managing the cotton gin at the time that is now the museum.
Mm-hmm.
The owner tell me that he became jealous of the publicity that Milam and Bryant was receiving for killing Emmett. Until he goes right down the street here in Glendora and kills another young man in town here to get him some publicity.
Wow. So y'all really had some, like, really cold-blooded murderers, Klan type, down in that area.
Yeah, it was really, really tough. And I guess that spirit has pretty much been upon us to keep us really to put us back as a field, cotton field. Glendora rose from the cotton fields and they attempted, look like, continued to attempt to take it back to that same cotton field as it was before. As a result of those heinous acts and incidents and crimes, the spirit here is real heavy. And, of course, we hope to ensure that such ugly head never raises again through our educational and to keep aware and in the forefront the plight of Emmett and the human wrongs that took place back then.
And I hope that never comes back too, Mayor. Again, tonight's segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by New Solution Social Media Services. Their website is newsolutionsocialmedia.com. We're also tonight segment of Center Stage is being brought to you by Texas Investor Realty. Go and see Robert Lewis over there if you're trying to buy a house here in the Metroplex at 214-467-0467 is how he can be reached. Listen, we're going to go to the phone line. So if you have a question for the mayor, get on the phone lines now. Dial us up at 347-850-8390. Again, if you have a question for Mayor Thomas about what happened the night Emmett Till was killed, get on the phones. Call us up at 347-850-8390. There's a couple of calls that's been holding for a while, so we're going to go to area code 404-343. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Hello, Ms. Carey. How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
I'm okay. I was listening to the story, and I started feeling a little nauseous, to be honest. Mm. I mean, that was a very, very, very frightening experience mm-hmm. for a young man. I mean, I felt frightened just listening to the mayor myself. I felt frightened, you know, mm-hmm. and I feel like, well, you know, Jim Crow is still here, you know. Jim Crow hasn't disappeared. I just feel like today, you know, black people are experiencing even more racism and social injustice mm-hmm. in American society. And, you know, to me, nothing has really changed except, you know, this is 2013. That's it, you know. It's a different day. But we have the same social and economic issues today as we did back in 1950 or back in the 1800s, to be honest. Mm-hmm. You know, our level of wealth, you know, is basically on the same level as it was back in the 1800s, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, collective wealth as a people, you know. So, you know, it's less than one half of 1% mm-hmm. that we control in terms of wealth. You know, and, you know, that was very frightening. I just felt frightened. I felt nauseous while listening to the mayor, like I said. And I can't imagine, you know, I just can't imagine having gone through what people went through back in 1955. I really can't. I cannot imagine that. I mean, no matter what we hear, no matter what we read, you know, we can read all the history books we want to read about what happened during the Civil Rights era or, you know, what happened to Emmett Till. You cannot imagine. You and I cannot imagine because we did not grow up during that time period.
No.
You know, it's hard for us to really imagine what black people really went through during that time. I mean, you guys can tell us your story. Whew, that was scary.
And, you know, that I think the really one thing that I told the mayor that I had a problem with uh-huh. is, you know, people today don't live with the same fear of dying that they seem to have lived with in the slavery and the Jim Crow era. And
yeah,
so I think, yeah, that's the difference today. You know, black people, I don't think, are ever going to go back to being that afraid of white people. You know what I mean?
Okay.
And so I think that's the difference. And, you know, maybe things are in many ways the same, but I think that what's really changed is that people are just not that afraid anymore.
Okay.
You know, I guess we've been so numb to seeing people die in front of us, you know, whether that be crime in the neighborhood or whatever, that people just, they're just not that afraid of death anymore. But thank you, Alberta. I'm going to move on. I'm going to go to area code 312 that's been holding for a while. 312-221. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
Hello?
Hello?
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Can you hear me?
We can.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Can you hear me now? Huh? You can hear
okay.
me?
Okay. Okay, yes, we can. That's the last time I'm going to say that. We can hear you.
Okay, I was listening to the whole talk show, and I'm from Chicago. Originally, my place of nativity is Jamaica, Queens, New York.
Okay.
And my god sister prompted me to listen to the program, who was Alberta Parrish, who's a very intelligent young lady. She's a book writer and everything. And I understand. I listened to everything, and I can probably understand the fact that it's hard to for a person today to understand totally what it was like. I know it was horrific being in that day, and it was something that was really, really terrifying. But I'm glad that we have progressed in a lot of ways. I thank God for that we've moved forward in a lot of ways. But I also realize that if it was any nation, whether it was black or Hispanic or whatever, we're living in the struggle of nations. And like Earth, Wind, and Fire said, life is very fair, but so on cool. But, and if everything is not right, but certain things, you know, I'm glad that we're advancing in civilization in a lot of ways. And I know slavery in some ways is still existent, or there's a still struggle of nations. You know, and my godmother here in Chicago, Illinois, was listening with me. And she was saying to me as we were listening that, you know, we have empathy for that situation. It shouldn't have happened. And that's a landmark and a historical fact of what happened with Emmett Till. But she was also, because I was listening, and it was saying that all these people died. They're no longer living except for the woman that Emmett Till looked at. But then what we should also reflect on, not giving respect to that, giving respect to that, but also what happened with George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin. That should also be a reflection. That's probably another topic, but that should be reflected on, because the person shouldn't be stereotyped like that. You know what I'm saying? But we are judged sometimes by association, so we got to be careful how we dress and how we project. But it's sad that people do stereotype people like that. You know what I'm saying? But in Trayvon Martin, I believe he's honestly a good person. But you're judged by the company you keep sometimes and how you project. So that's, it sends out a statement that how we should adorn us in society and project. You know what I'm saying? For instance, people wearing their pants down, sagging, their underwear showing. When they come out of prison where you can't have the belt, and they have to progress. We have to progress because I'm going to tell you, like with Martin Luther King, I'm sure he missed a lot of happy days with Coretta Scott King. As a matter of fact, I got a job playing drums for Bernice King, passing Bernice King for a little while, and I met her and everything. She's a beautiful young lady. But I'm sure, you know, what must happen for us to progress? And affirmative action is cool also, but after that, after we get affirmative action, we as a people have to come together and be united and progress. We must do that.
I agree with that. Thank you.
Talk is cheap.
I agree. Thank you, caller.
We must progress. God bless you. Pray for me. Thank you.
God bless you. We're going to go to area 314, 381. Good evening. You're on Center Stage.
How you doing?
Fine. How are you?
Sure. It's Bianchi. You know, I keep hearing, what is the demographics of the town that the mayor represents? What percentage black?
100.
About 75 or 80% black? 100, you say?
Yeah.
So how much more uniting do we have to have than 100%? You know, I came up through them periods of the 50s and the 60s. Blacks today have everything, that the skills and talents to change their situation around. Blacks with skills and talents should take those skills and talents to the mayor's town and help them to be able to control the economy that they depend on for their sustenance in that area. That's how you get back at those period in times that we, you know, blacks, they have a vendetta against whites for a period that they never didn't even exist in. And it seems like that vendetta has caused a paralysis, whereas we just depend on government too damn much and live off of that vendetta. There's nothing preventing black people today from changing their situation around compared to what it was back in the 60s and even before that. And I wonder if the mayor think, what did the mayor think about what I just said?
Mayor? Oh, I'm sorry. The mayor got clicked off. I'm sorry. I had to get a call back in. I say, Mr. Mayor, did you hear the question?
Yes. Yes, I had to call back in. I got cut off some kind of way.
I see.
But what I think about that is that when you lived under the system of penance and coming out of Jim Crow, and when you came out of Jim Crow in the late 50s and 60s, we in this area here on up into the 80s and 90s, look like, and still here, it's a hard road to hoe. And that's what, and the reason I say that we want to just get a hand down and we will pull it ourselves up. But that's a hard thing to do, because nobody know how to do it that much. If you come to a small community, like a rural community, like the one that we're living in here, and the peonage and the heavy arm.
Well, Mayor, let me ask you a question. The blacks in the north, with all the skills and talents that they have of operating other people's businesses, being corporate managers, heads, and supervisors and so forth, would you say that blacks today have more potential to change their social economic conditions around themselves rather than waiting for somebody else to do it?
I would hope that we would do just as what the attempt that Marcus Garvey attempted. But he attempted to take a million or so of us back to Africa. I'd love to see us attempt here to pull a million or so of the million of us here together, and instead of under the same auspices as Marcus Garvey attempted.
Absolutely. And the fact that the town that you represent, the town that you represent is probably 100% black. There's no reason why I come. And I can understand the people in the community don't have the necessary skills and talent. But, you know, you have immigrants that come here from all around the world. They come here with skills. They use those skills to earn and have access to wealth. Then they send that wealth back home in order to build and make better for back home. Blacks in the north, with all the skills and talents that they have, those skills and talents could be used to control the economy that your people exist in, and they don't have the ability to control their trade and manufacture their production, that using affirmative action in the right way with manufacturing production in West Africa, having stuff imported back into your economic markets like your city, like the Jackson, Mississippi, like Mississippi period, which is 37% black. Louisiana is 33% black. South Carolina, those are large black economic markets that we need to control today and stop depending on government.
That's what I say. I say the only way that we're going to come out from under this as well is that we begin to do things with ourselves and for ourselves. That's strictly it. And that's what I'm saying today. Wait a minute. Don't give me any welfare and tell me that I can't have anything I want for money. Let me earn my dollar, and I can do what I want to do with it. Don't give me welfare. If you're going to give me $1,500 worth of welfare, then let me do $1,500 worth of work, and I can do what I'm supposed to do with those monies. And I think we will bring ourselves up by our own bootstraps.
I agree. Well, thank you, Mr. Pianki, for calling in tonight.
Yeah, you know, it would be nice if you done, you know, there should be a recording, you just done an interview. That needs to be archived. It needs to be recorded for future generations to be able to hear the story that he told. You know, we have elder people in our community that need to be video interviewed so that what they know in their head, the story that they can tell with the fine details and so on, firsthand experience can live on into the future.
Well, there's an effort. There's an effort here in Mississippi to reveal the good, the bad, and the ugly, and that is a $9 billion soon-to-be effort by the state of Mississippi to lure into the state of Mississippi based on our past history and our oral history that are being siphoned off from us to create an economy that we will be left out of. Because they're taking our oral history and they're calling it the good, the bad, and the ugly. And it's being schooled internationally.
And blacks should not allow that to happen. If they allow that to happen, you know, 50 years from now, we'll still be whining and crying about what they done to us. Look, Carrie, you carry on. You're doing a very good job.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Mayor, so...
They were naming that effort, the good, the bad, and the ugly, authentic Mississippi.
Mr. Mayor, let's talk a little bit about I want to call them characters because they're real people. What became of Uncle Mose after Emmett Till died?
Uncle Mose came back to Mississippi. He left immediately after the Emmett trial and went to Argo, Illinois. And he came back. He said he had promised that he would come back one more time, and that was to attend the grand jury hearing in LeFleur County, of which they decided not to indict Milam and Bryant for kidnapping. He did come back, and the last time he came back.
And what happened with Simeon? Simeon was the young man that came down, him and Reverend Parker. They were the ones that came down from Chicago with Emmett Till. What became of them?
Well, Simeon was already here. That's who Emmett came to visit, Simeon. He was Uncle Mo's son.
Okay.
It was just Reverend Parker and Emmett that came down.
Okay. So what became of Simeon?
Simeon is in Chicago. He's just written Simeon's story. He's calling it the rest of the story. But
really?
He's called Simeon's story. He's written a book recently.
About what happened the night they killed Emmett Till?
Right, the night that they took him out of the bed with him.
Wow. And so members of your community, along with yourself, formed the Emmett Till Memorial Museum. So for someone coming to visit that, what will they find?
When you come to visit the Ethic Museum, the Emmett Till Historic Intrepid Center, tried to get me to name it Interpretive Center, but we felt that it would be best to be intrepid. Intrepid, of course, we would never be fearful as we was, as Uncle Mose was during that time and as they was when they gave Emmett away. So intrepid meaning that we will never have that type of fear again. That's why we named it Intrepid Center, because we knew Mose was, fear was that they might take all of the boys.
Wow.
And Emmett was not fearful. So intrepidness is perfect because of him not having fear and not knowing the way of the South and being a young boy. We named the museum Intrepid.
And so for someone visiting the museum, we talked about the story tonight. What will they get in the tour of the museum?
If you visit the Ethic Museum, you actually visit an authentic Mississippi. You're visiting a place of historic significance in that it's a cotton gin, and that cotton was the backbreaker of African Americans and how the South was made rich and famous and so forth through cotton. Based on how we picked it, that's the cotton gin that you will be visiting. And also, this cotton gin is historic in that it is the place where they took a fan from in order to try and dispose of Emmett's body to ensure that it would never surface again, a 70-plus pound fan and tied barbed wire to it. You would find those authentic, but you would find those artifacts replicating or referencing those things such as the cotton fan. You would find the history from 1860 to present. We are call ourselves a living museum in that we hope to have this museum to display all of the future history of those young folks that are coming along now. So you will find the history all the way up through 1979, where you will find that in this museum, you would find me parallel in Emmett Till, where I was elected the first African American in this county. That
really?
Was created in 1933. Mm-hmm. And I the first to be elected as a county government person in this county, which mm-hmm. took me 2 years later after winning, beating out 5 Caucasian in the first round in 1975. And then I began to run for county supervisor, which was a push train. And it took me 10 years to finally find out that they were still in it and taking the election from me each time in an 80% district, of which I lived only 30 days as a county supervisor because they took me to state court, to federal court, back to state court, back to federal court, and to the state of Mississippi Supreme Court, all within a month's time to prevent me from holding that office. You will find that history in there along with all of the history dealing with the voting rights and civil rights and sovereignty, Mississippi Sovereignty Commission, which if you was progressive in Mississippi, you were placed in these records and files and and so forth. And, the museum is a wealth of knowledge and history.
Oh,
the state of Mississippi just passed new law allowing black history or history to be African-American history to be taught year-round. When passed, it was only for 1 month.
Let's talk about the connection between you and Emmett Till. The mayor, this is fascinating, how he was 1 year, 8 months, and 28 days on August 28, 1955, the day that Emmett Till's body was discovered, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And tell us how that connects with everything and how your social and everything connects with that.
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, my mother, my father was involved in this case, and that she, my mom, I called her the original snitcher because she's the original person that told the media that kidnapping had taken place and as well. But when they pulled the body of Emmett out and they sent it, after exhuming it, sent it to Chicago, they sent it to funeral home there, which came to.
Okay, did we lose you, Mayor? Okay, we're going to have to give him a second to. I think he dropped off the call. But the mayor's going to come back in a second. For whatever reason, his phone keeps dropping. The mayor's going to come back in a minute and tell us how significant his social is and the fact of how old he was connects with the day in which they found the body of Emmett Till. Fascinating story. And when he told me, at first I had to write it all down to make it make sense, and then when I realized just how connected it was. But the story was just so fascinating to me, y'all, when I listened to the mayor tell. You know, we in the media here in this country, we've heard, you know, the story of Emmett Till and what happened. But it was nothing like hearing it from an African-American that was connected to the story. You know, his very father was one of the black men, one of the 5 black men that was involved in the torture, the kidnapping, the torture, the murder, and the disposing of the body. It doesn't get any closer to history than that. And so just bringing the mayor on tonight, who was with us last week, when we talked about Glendora, Mississippi, it was just, I couldn't believe when he told me the story. I was thinking, this is just unreal, because I myself had never really looked at the Emmett Till story until this week. I'd heard over the years what the media had said, but never taken the time to actually do the research and to just listen to him tell us what happened based on his knowledge, his personal knowledge of his father being involved was just an incredible history lesson. And so we're waiting on him to call back in. For whatever reason, the boards keep dropping his, call tonight. And so we're going to refresh the screen and hopefully pick the mayor back up. But for whatever reason, he keeps getting dropped off this evening. And we apologize to the mayor for that. We don't know if it's our connection that's doing it or if it's his connection that's actually dropping him off. So we're going to hope that he can get back in and complete the story. Let's give him a second. But if anybody's got any questions about any of the things that we talked about tonight, the museum is in Glendora, Mississippi, and the mayor, along with some other people, run that museum, and the history is rich. It's quite a tour, and I plan myself to go to Glendora one day and actually visit the museum. The mayor obviously is having an incredible time getting back into the phone lines. We're not sure what happened and why he got dropped. Let's try one more time to refresh the screen, and hopefully we'll find him and figure out what happened. Give us a second. We're not sure why the mayor can't get back in. We apologize tonight, y'all. We're not sure what happened to the mayor, but he's been dropped 3 times on the phone line, so we keep connecting him back on seamlessly. But tonight, for whatever reason, he's not able to get back in, it seems, and we're not sure why. Okay, well, we're going to give him a few more minutes, and then we're just going to close out because we're pretty close to the top of the hour anyway. But I have enjoyed tonight, y'all, listening to the mayor tell us about the night that Emmett Till died, all the details that were left out of the media. And the mayor's back with us, thank God, so he can finish telling the story. Mr. Mayor, we're not sure why you keep getting dropped off tonight. No, maybe somebody doesn't want you to tell this story. I'm not sure. But we just keep getting dropped off tonight. Let me go back to the phone
line.
Let's take one more caller. Let's take one more call tonight, Mayor, just before we get out of here. 682-202,
okay.
Good evening. You're on center stage.
Hey, good evening, Kara. How you doing?
How you doing?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. I definitely can relate to story calls. Me, myself, personally, I'm from Greenville, Mississippi.
No.
Yes, ma'am. And the reason
so that's
why you
in the
have
Delta,
so
right?
much. Oh, it's in a deep Delta.
Yes.
And the reason why you have things are still so bad, right before I left, I talked to the mayor myself, which her name is Heather Hudson. I'm going to just call out and tell it like it is.
Okay.
And the reason why things got so bad is a lot of industries wanted to come into that town, but she said the people would get paid too much money, so she wanted to keep them down. So she kept all the industries out, which was really a form of modern-day slavery. And a lot of people, you don't know how it is until you've actually been there. And the mayor, he's 100% right. This stuff nowadays, I mean, it was open back then, but nowadays it's covered up, but it still goes on everywhere you go.
And so how close is that to Glendora?
We're about 70 miles.
Yes,
about 70 miles.
Yes, ma'am.
Are you familiar with that mayor?
Oh, yeah, Heather McTeer Hudson, yes.
Yeah, Heather McTeer Hudson, yes, sir.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. And so she actually did not want industry to come in there because the people of the town would make too much money?
Yes, and she looked just like us, which is African-American.
Hmm.
Other than she might be one of the 1%ers, though.
Yes, sir.
That's the kind of situation we had over here. In our community here, we have a billionaire that lives right here in the community, and that's what have our, what did you call it, per income? The income that we have here, $7,500
right.
or something like that.
Oh, and, the poverty line.
Poverty, yeah, way below the poverty line. But then we have a billionaire right here in the community who served and always have served on everything, the industrial, the economic development, all of those areas to hold down and to prevent any development further than what the plantation individual earned, which is about $8,000 and something for 10 and 12 and 14 hours per day work. And any industry coming in will cause a problem for them having to pay more money or might unionize or something like that. They don't let it happen. And that's the, Bianca, that other hard part that we have to fight, because we, the people who are in charge won't allow it to happen.
Wow.
Other than what they want to happen, and that is to keep you just as the speaker just finished saying, keeping you at the bottom.
Mm.
Yes, sir. And Kara, do you mind
you decide,
just
so
add
you
one
decide.
More thing?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I just wanted to say the last time I was back home, I was going to open a coffee shop, and I was going to employ some of the people that was looking for jobs for pretty much 6 months to a year. And when I went to City Hall, which is right there on Washington Street, the lady behind the counter, she didn't even want to give me the permits and the paperwork I needed to get it started. So I had to pretty much fight with the lady to get a business started right in the city. So it still goes on today.
Hmm. Wow. And you know, so what is the answer, caller? I mean, if they're fighting you like that, what is the answer?
Kara, I don't think we have enough time on this line.
Okay.
I'm just being honest with you. But it's
okay.
Going to get better. I believe it's going to get better.
Well, you know what? Then I tell you what, caller. The mayor is looking for businesses to come to Glendora. Maybe you ought to take your business to Glendora. Am I right, Mayor?
I think so.
That's right. Or send it here. We would make it happen for them. Give us a hand down here, and we'll pull up. We'll pull up.
Yeah. The mayor is looking for businesses. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking of doing some stuff in Glendora myself. So the mayor is very much looking for businesses to come to Glendora.
Okay, I'll do that, Kara. I'll send you my information. This is booked on. I'll send you my information on the Facebook page.
Do that. Thank you so much, and I'll pass it on to the mayor. Thank
Appreciate
you.
It.
So, Mr. Mayor, so we only got a few minutes left in the segment, about 8 minutes left in the segment. And so, you know, thank you, first of all, for being with me tonight and sharing the Emmett Till story. What a rich, rich history lesson that was. And so is there anything you want to leave us with tonight about the Emmett Till story?
Well, Gary, as I said before, we were the beginning. Rosa Parks said that she wasn't tired because all she had done was sew all day. She thought about what happened back in Mississippi to that boy from Chicago, and that was Emmett Till. And she froze and could not go to the back of the bus. Therefore, we, and the premeditation that took place in that case and the involvement of the African-Americans under duress, and the Caucasian from this community. We say that we are the cradle and the birthplace of modern civil rights. And we have made our every effort, and our museum is, and our theme of the museum is The Healing Begins. We were the birthplace of it, and we will be where the healing begins from Glendora. And that healing, as we've attempted to hopefully get Oprah, we sent her a letter. It's been quite a while. We've not heard back from her, but we sent a letter to her asking her to help us to break bread and to attempt to bring together those family members from the other side along with those family members from this side. And let's sit down and see what has happened to us as a result of the sins of our fathers.
Now, when you
that
say,
is what I want to see happen.
Well, you mean, I'm sorry, I want to be clear. So you mean the Emmett Till family members versus the Brian and Milam family members and sit them on the couch together?
Me, as being African-American father and so forth, being involved, the Till family and foundation, as well as the Milam and Bryant families that are still in existence, we should come together to begin this healing. And that's my effort, is to bring those people and we sit down and to see what has happened and how we can change what the sins of our fathers.
Well, let me ask you this, because I ain't Oprah, but I sure will try to bring it together. I ain't scared, that's for sure. So let me ask you this. So as far as the Milam family and the Bryant family, are they still in the area?
There are Bryants and Milams in the area.
No.
Yeah. There are Bryants and Milams in there. As a matter of fact, there's a JW in the area. Probably a great nephew or something, but there's a JW in the area. And there are some Bryants that lives in Washington County, where the speaker just said he was from, in Greenville. That's where most recently Mrs. Bryant lived prior to going to North Carolina. She lived in the town where he's from.
That is incredible. I would have thought they all, because, you know, you said Mr. Roy, you said Roy Bryant and JW had kind of moved around, I guess, because the story just wouldn't die wherever they went, so they'd have to kind of move around. So I would have thought the whole family would have moved, but you're saying some of them are still in the area.
Oh, yes. They're still here, farmers, some in the police office business in Grenada County. And I know some.
Well, do they talk about it anymore, or do they try to avoid that subject, to your knowledge?
Well, the Sheriff Strider family members, the county created a Emmett Till Memorial Commission to apologize for what took place here in Mississippi and in Tallahatchie County, the injustice that occurred. So our commission is a 50-50 commission, African-American and white. And some of the Strider families attempted to serve on that committee as well. We don't have any Milams or Bryants on it, but we did have some Striders on it.
And the Striders are who?
That's the sheriff, great
grandfather,
attempted to serve.
Okay, y'all, I tried to do justice tonight to the story of what happened the night Emmett Till died. I got to say thank you to Mr. Mayor for being with me 2 weeks in a row. Thank you so much, Mr. Mayor. I definitely enjoyed you. And I hope everybody learned tonight what happened the night that Emmett Till died. Listen, y'all, we do this each and every Friday night from 8 to 10 p.m. Central, 9 to 11 Eastern. If you have a story you'd like Center Stage to cover, drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. That's centerstageradio@yahoo.com, and we'll definitely consider it. Also, we'd like you to think about advertising here on Center Stage. Also, drop me a line at centerstageradio@yahoo.com. Again, I'd like to say thank you to the mayor for being with me tonight, and also thank you, the audience, for tuning in tonight. And we'll see you next week, same channel, same time, right here, Center Stage. Good night.